Good morning, happy Sunday, and welcome to On the Weekend Edition. I am your host, Brian Pettaway, and like every Sunday, I'll be here with you again for an hour from 9 until 10. Now, the last couple of weeks has gone over because the interview that I had with the transgender young lady, Aris Wanzer, lasted a very long time, but it was great. I've got lots of great feedback from it, so thank you very much for tuning in. This week, I have another great show. We're going to talk about something that's not really talked about a whole lot, especially in the black community, and that is mental health. May, for many of us who did not know, is Mental Health Awareness Month. And so I wanted to bring attention to that because, you know, black people, especially black men, find it very difficult, as with our physiological health, to find help with our emotional and neurological health. Generationally, there's been this quiet stigma attached to black men that seek emotional and psychological therapy. Now, there are multiple reasons for that. And instead of me trying to figure out why that is on my own, I actually have a professional here today that's going to sit with me and dive deep into the subject of mental health and explain why it's just as important to get our emotional, spiritual, and mental healthy as it is as our physical. So I want you guys to pay close attention to what my guest says today, because what she says may help you detect early in someone and ourselves signs of loneliness, signs of depression, suicidal language, erratic behavior due to high stress. All of these things we're going to talk about today. And one of the most important things we're going to talk about is how to approach people who we feel are exhibiting these behaviors and going through these problems. Because it's one thing to recognize it in a friend or a loved one. It's another thing to know how to approach them and speak to them about getting help for it. Also, of course, we're going to talk to the Petty today. He is with us, and he's got some more information about the NFL, the USFL, and the XFL. Now, he's gone off script a couple of times the last couple of weeks, and he's talked about baseball, boxing, basketball. And it's, you know, I got to be honest, when you know, you know. And the information that he has given the last couple of weeks have been spot on. So I'm very interested in his segment and seeing what he has for us this week. Right now, though, you've got me. And I'm going to talk about some things that have gone on in this country in this last week or so that are pretty concerning to me. And I can't imagine that once you've heard them, they won't be concerning to you as well. Now, in recent shows, I've kind of gotten away from the news segment of the show so that I could better explain the topic that I've chosen for that show in a monologue. But being very honest, news is my first love. It's my passion. There's something about knowing what's going on in the world in which I live that makes me feel more comfortable living in that world. Now, in this state, there are some big things going on. And one of the big deals that we have in the state of Maryland is Governor Wes Moore. Make no mistake about it, he is a rising star in the Democratic Party. And I suspect that we're only going to have him for one term as governor in the state of Maryland. But during the time that we have Wes Moore, we need to pay close attention to what he's doing and how he's doing it. For example, at a time when Republican-led states are restricting or banning abortion and limiting gender-affirming care, our governor is signing measures into law, like he did on Wednesday, to protect abortion rights and not deny or limit, but expand Medicaid coverage for gender-affirming treatment in this state. There are currently 11 states in the union that have abortion laws on the books that make abortion illegal within their state. Alabama, Arkansas, Idaho, Kentucky, Texas, Tennessee, to name a few, and of course Florida. Which means that if you are caught trying to get an abortion, if you are a doctor performing an abortion, or even if you are a neighbor or friend assisting someone to an abortionist, giving them a ride, you are subject to criminal penalties consisting of fines or possible jail time. What Governor Moore did on Wednesday was sign a new law in this state designed to protect patients and providers from criminal, civil, and administrative penalties relating to the abortion bans and penalties that I spoke of earlier that exist in other states. Now, the other bill that he signed relating to this is to ensure public colleges and universities in this state have a plan for student access to birth control, including emergency contraception and the very controversial abortion pill. Now, brilliantly, there are two things that this law does immediately in the state of Maryland. A, it absolutely strengthens the laws already on the books in the state of Maryland that protect the reproductive and abortion rights of women, which I think is crazy that we even have to have a conversation about, but it does that, and I think it's great. But the other thing that it does is that it ups the enrollment of universities and colleges within this state. Make no mistake about it, young people are concerned about abortion rights in this country because it is a fact that most young people do their most sexual exploration and experimenting between the ages of 17 and 24. And although that is natural and expected, what's also natural and expected is that these young people are at that age the most irresponsible sexually. And knowing that reality, a lot of kids, in particular young women, are enrolling in colleges and universities where the abortion laws in that state will not restrict them from being able to make their own decision about what they do with their future if they should get pregnant, which will up the enrollment rate in a state like Maryland. And everyone knows, as the student population rates rise in the state of Maryland, so will the revenue. Now, I'm not suggesting for a minute that the governor made the decision to sign these laws this week solely for the reason that I just spoke of. I honestly feel he believes in a woman's right to choose and to be in complete control of her healthcare decision. But I also believe the timing of these bills being signed in late April, early May, lets us know that he is aware that kids are making final decisions about where they are going to enroll in school in August and September. And so putting these bills into law at this time is his way of saying to parents and kids that if you enroll in a college in the state of Maryland, you're safe. And I think the timing of it is brilliant. Something else that's going on in the city of Baltimore is a bill that I could potentially have a lot of problems with, and I'm sure other people will have problems with it as well. Now, in a move introduced by Progressive Councilman Christopher Burnett this past week, he introduced a bill to the Baltimore City Council that would make the willful use of the incorrect name or pronouns of an individual unlawful across various sectors such as housing, employment, education, and public accommodation. That means that if I am a store owner, a real estate agent, a teacher or principal in a school, and I see that you are biologically a male and refer to you as that after you've told me that you're female, that I could be breaking the law. Now, to be fair, the terms in the bill that are used, the phrases in the bill that are used, are willingly and repeatedly, meaning if it's deemed that I did it intentionally and or repeatedly after I've been told that you want to be referred to something other than what I see, then I could potentially be breaking the law. Now again, I'm in my 50s, but even if I were not, right? If I see one person and I refer to that one person in the singular as he or she, but that person's pronoun preference is they or them, it doesn't mean that you tell me that information on Monday, then I'm going to remember it on Wednesday when I see you as a singular person again, because my vernacular is one of a 50-year-old person who has always referred to a singular person in singular terms. Now, I could be breaking a law if this bill passes, and I think it's a very, very slippery slope because no one knows what intentional is. I mean, in a city where we average over 330 homicides and over 600 non-fatal shootings a year, can you imagine summoning police through 911 calls to a pronoun emergency? And, you know, we might sit back and think that's ridiculous and even laugh about it a little bit now. But we know, you and I both know, that that's exactly what's going to happen as soon as a law is passed that using the wrong pronoun is illegal. We know it's going to happen. It's inevitable. So, Councilman Christopher Burnett, I understand where your heart is. I understand you want everyone to be comfortable and feel included and not discriminated against. I get it. Trust me, I get it. But sometimes common sense has to take over. And this bill is truly a solution looking for a problem. And my final piece of news before we get into today's interview with my guest is Donald Trump is in serious trouble, y'all. Trump is in so much trouble with his indictment in New York State that his attorneys have asked that his indictment in New York State court be transferred to federal court. Do you know how much trouble you have to be in to request such a transfer? And on top of that, at the same time that this hush money trial is going on, two blocks away in a Manhattan federal court, the other part of his defense team is in the civil rape and defamation case brought by Elle Magazine's E. Jean Carroll. And apparently, that's not going so well for him either. Apparently, she is an incredibly good witness, and the fact that the Donald has made a decision not to sit in his defense, not even in the courtroom during this case, has not been a very smart strategic move because all the jury can see is the victim. That's it. So, I mean, I know, listen, I'm skeptical too. I have been skeptical. I mean, Mar-a-Lago didn't touch him and the top secret papers that he lied about having. The January 6th inquiry didn't touch him, although other people in his cabinet were hurt and indicted. He wasn't touched. And so, yeah, I mean, it's easy to say as far as the federal government goes, he has been Teflon Don, completely untouchable. But these aren't federal hearings. These aren't federal judges. These are state hearings in state courthouses. And I got to tell you, it's looking completely different. And so I'm optimistic. I mean, I really, really am. But regardless, he's been arrested, the first U.S. president to be arrested and charged criminally. So that alone lets you know that New York State is not playing with this cat. They're just not playing with him. So I'm eager to see what the outcome is. I mean, I really am. All right. So like I mentioned earlier, this is May, and May is Mental Health Awareness Month. And there's so much to be said about what's going on in regards to the decline of mental health in this country. Now, suicide rates among teens are way up. Drug addiction and overdose among teens is way up. In fact, in some pockets of the country, parents have just conceded because overdose is so prevalent there that emergency first responders can't keep up. So parents have been trained how to apply Narcan to their children who overdose to bring them back from the brink of death. Can you imagine keeping a drug in your house that is not for a headache and it's not for a stomach ache? Its only purpose is to bring your child back from death because you know that it's inevitable that they're going to overdose and kill themselves at some point. Well, I mean, it's the reality of a lot of parents in this country. A lot of parents in this country. The question is why have things gotten so bad with teens? Why is the suicide rate and the overdose rate, the drug addiction rate so high in this country amongst our children? Why are there so many mass shootings in this country? Why is the rate of alcohol consumption increasing in this country? Why is the one thing that nobody seems to want to talk about? Why is homelessness absolutely spiking in this country? The amount of homeless people in this country right now sits at 523,000 human beings that have nowhere to go. They have no home. And I'm not just talking 523,000 men, but I'm talking men, women, whole families with children that have no home, sleeping on the streets, sleeping in a car, under a bridge, in a tent sometime. And listen, I'm not trying to bring anybody down on this Sunday. I know it's hard stuff to hear, but it's real stuff. These are the real things that are going on in this country. It is the state of our union right now. And some of the most difficult things to talk about are the most important things to talk about. And one of those things that is driving this state is depression. Why is depression so prevalent amongst teens and adults in this country? I mean, what is really going on? Well, Dr. Vivek Murthy, who is the U.S. Surgeon General, came out with a report last week that stated isolation and loneliness has been declared an epidemic in this country. Now, of course, when I read this report, I was fascinated. But one of the things that struck me is how important social contact is. But now we have all of this technology that has allowed us to be independent of each other. Telework, for example. People aren't going into the office anymore nearly as much as they used to. And so, yes, it's convenient, but where's the social contact that we need daily? Amazon shopping. I mean, you can have basically anything you want delivered to your doorstep. I literally got some orange tangerine nowlaters that I couldn't find anywhere. I found them on Amazon. People aren't walking around the malls anymore. They're not going to the stores anymore. You're not going to bump into the love of your life in the mall like you used to. Kids aren't hanging out at the mall like they used to. We used to think it was a pain in the ass, but we needed that social contact. I mean, you can even order your groceries online. I hated going to the grocery store, hated it. But what I didn't realize is that every time I went to the grocery store, I at least spoke to someone. I spoke to somebody, the butcher possibly, right? Excuse me, your cart's blocking me. That's social interaction, right? I'm talking to another human being who's acknowledging me and talking back. The cashier you definitely spoke to. And usually there was some pleasantries spoken, right? They acknowledge you, you acknowledge them. Social interaction. Well, now they've got self-checkout. You don't even have a cashier more than half the time. My point is that all of these conveniences that have been created and designed and invented so that we can be unbothered and independent of each other, well, it's killing us. And look, I don't mean to sound dramatic. Again, I'm not trying to bring anybody down, but it clearly states in the Surgeon General's report, he clearly outlines it, that isolation and loneliness increases premature death by 60%. 60%. That's more than half. You know what I mean? And we're talking death here. So I'm not being dramatic when I say that the lack of interaction and social contact between human beings is killing us. And listen, as fascinated as I am with this subject, I am not an expert. I still don't understand a whole lot of this stuff. But I did find someone who can explain it to me, can explain it to us. And I'm very fortunate to have her here today. She is by all measures an expert in the field of educational and neurological psychology. And she's been generous enough with her time today to break some stuff down and explain it to someone like me. 1500 family, please help me welcome to On the Weekend Edition, Dr. Carol Yvette Baldwin. Dr. Baldwin, how are you this morning?
I'm fine, thank you. How are you?
Doing well. I appreciate you so much for being with us this morning. I know you have a busy schedule, so I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Dr. Baldwin, you're actually a native of Chicago, is that correct?
That is correct. Born and raised in Chicago, Illinois. Came to Maryland to work. Worked in the school system in Chicago for about 8 years in the schools as a school psychologist, and then wanted to get a little bit more experience and wanted to get a little bit more exposure. So I moved out to Maryland, and mostly because the school system was one of the top in the country. And so I wanted to get the experience of going from a complete urban area to a more diverse population.
Okay. Did you find that here?
I did. When I shifted from Chicago Public Schools, I actually went from working with students in a general education population to more students with severe profound disabilities. So I have a background in neuropsychology, and I started working with students that were identified as severe profound on the autism spectrum and severe chromosome disorders and syndromes and things like that. So I got to work with a very specific kind of population and really trying to help educators to understand their learning style, their learning patterns, right, and ways to help them to actually learn within the environment.
I always ask my guests, like, what inspired or motivated them to get into the field they're in? What was your inspiration? What motivated you to become a psychologist?
So I have always felt that I have had a compassionate heart. I think I am a servant leader, and I always have been. But as growing up in high school, I had a very dear friend of mine whose brother was identified with a disability. At the time, I didn't really understand what his disability was, didn't really know what it was. I just knew he was different from what we were learning like.
Right.
And I found it to be just very interesting to be able to help him in different ways and needing to think outside the box when we were around him to really kind of help him to understand and be integrated into the things that we were doing. And so that was probably my first introduction. And then I have a cousin who has cerebral palsy. And again, just trying to help people understand what her learning style was and her learning pattern was.
Mm-hmm. Now, honestly, back in the day, like back in the early 70s, I remember a lot of times when Black families had the quote-unquote special person in the family, you rarely mm-hmm. saw them out and about. We kind of hid them as opposed to trying to understand them. We dealt with them in-house.
Right.
Now, there's been, thankfully, a huge transition from that treatment to trying to understand the neurological disorders that lie within some people. Have you found that to be true, in particular in the Black community?
I have found that to be true. We are a little bit more aware of disabilities. We're a little bit more compassionate, and we're definitely more knowledgeable about them.
Awesome. You've got quite the resume. You got quite the educational resume. Let me see. You have a Bachelor of Science in Finance, a Master's of Education in School Psychology, a PhD in Counseling and Educational Psychology, and a minor in Neurological Psychology. You even have a Master's of Divinity in Pastoral Care.
I do. It sounds like a lot.
It is a lot.
It is, but the theme of all of my training is I'm an analyst. So I'm an analyst of any type of behavior. So with the finance degree, it's an analyst of finances in the psychology area is an analyst of behaviors, and in theology it's an analyst of different kinds of behaviors and spirits. So
now, do they all mesh for you at some point? Like, do you use all of these, this educational background?
Yes. Okay. Yes. Yes. And pastoral care is really looking at, if you will, the psychology, when you being able to apply those psychological principles within the theological framework.
Okay. So really quick, explain to my listeners the difference of a psychologist and a psychiatrist.
Very simple difference. We both have the training in the science areas, but a psychiatrist prescribes medication. A psychologist usually does not.
Okay.
A psychiatrist usually has a medical degree as well.
A psychiatrist does.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you've been in the school system between, I guess, Chicago and Maryland for like, what, 20 plus years or so?
A little more than 20 years, yes.
Okay. And you said you were in the urban areas of Chicago dealing with kids.
Yes.
Did you find their stresses different from what you find here in Maryland and Montgomery County?
So here's the thing.
Okay.
Children are children, no matter where you have them. It is the exposure, the society, and the environment that they are around that tend to shape them. So what I found to be different really has to do with the environmental factors.
Okay. And that's what I meant. I mean, they call Chicago Chirac, all kinds of stuff, with all the violence. Now, there's a lot of violence in Baltimore, but with all of the violence and the attention to it in Chicago in particular, did you find that those kids were, I guess, more stressed or more highly stressed than those in Montgomery County that you see?
No.
No. Okay.
No. And the reason that I say, that is because I'm going to go back to environmental factors. So violence and trauma and mental health concerns, substance abuse, academic pressure, they're everywhere. The environmental factors always make the difference. You mentioned Chicago being referred to as Chirac. That is probably a more recent title or name or categorization that Chicago has gotten over, I would say, the last 10 years or so. I've been out of Chicago for quite some time.
Okay.
But
okay.
I can tell you that my dissertation looked at the effects of violence and post-traumatic stress on kids' ability to achieve. So I did look at that. At the time, I was looking at, and it's still prevalent now, at really the breakdown and the shootings within schools and how kids kind of bounce back from violent and traumatic kind of events.
So what, they're more mental and emotional resilient than they used to be? I mean,
they are. That's hard to say, because resiliency is something that I'm really looking at a lot now with students. I would say that the issues have not really shifted too much. And I don't think it's just a Chicago, Maryland thing, because I think about school shootings that happen or violence that happens in schools like all across the nation, even within the college campuses now. Those kinds of resiliency patterns are things that I'm currently studying and currently looking at.
Okay, so the studying for you never stops, so to speak.
No, it doesn't stop. No, it never stops.
So your approach to children, do you counsel adults at all?
I do. I mostly deal with students, though. I deal with children, and mostly because of the developmental factors. It's not that adults don't have those same kinds of things. It's just my area of expertise is really looking at those developmental places and those places of impact and impasse that happen within the developmental years. So even if I'm talking to adults and I'm helping to consult with them and trying to move them past an impasse, I usually try to go back to, where did this all start?
Okay. I'm glad I'm talking to you, someone who was doing this in the school system, because I know how kids have it, and it's, you know, and I know they can be stressed and they need counseling,
mm-hmm.
but teachers are going through it. I mean, they are going through the ringers. Who is taking care of them?
That is a really good question. And I can tell you within our district, we definitely try to assist the teachers. Like, I don't limit myself to the students. I never turn anyone around if they come in into my office and needing to kind of talk or decompress or, you know, just try to move past a situation. But that is a really good question. And I think those are things that systems are starting to really look at, particularly after the pandemic. I think there pre-pandemic, there were some things that were going on that, you know, they could look at EAP and they could look at employee assistance programs and they could look at different wellness type platforms and social emotional training that they could do. And they could probably reach a good percentage of teachers and the adults that were working. But after the pandemic, that whole idea of societal loneliness kicked in, which is the understanding that there's this collective loneliness and disconnection and isolation mm-hmm. that happens.
Right.
A lot of that started really raising its head after the pandemic because everybody was isolated.
Yeah, I have a friend that just, well, didn't just, but 3 years ago, quit a teaching position because she said she felt like she was suffering from PTSD, and she started getting yeah. counseling for that particular symptom.
Yeah.
And she said if she had had a therapist or psychologist on staff at the school that she could speak to kind of regularly, then maybe it would not have manifested itself into the problem that it became. But the union didn't have anyone that they would refer her to, and they weren't willing to pay for it. Like, she had to pay for it out of her pocket.
That's so you touched on several things. Okay. So there should be a school psychologist in almost every school. We are like, I wish I could say that I'm unique to this field, but I'm not. We have an entire national organization, and every school district has school psychologists. So we are definitely present. We are definitely there. So we are involved. The challenge with our profession, however, is that there are not enough of us.
Okay.
And so that's when, and that goes for even with working with the students. When you start talking about teachers leaving the profession, particularly post-pandemic, it's not just the mental health. I'm going to go back to that social isolation, societal loneliness piece. That social isolation impacted households as well as school systems, as well as the students, as well as the adults.
Right.
Nobody was safe during that. So in coming back into a school system, even if some districts came in earlier than others, when you come back in, you have to factor in the fact that everybody has been impacted. Some districts were very good at that, and some districts maybe not so much. It's hard for me to judge that, but you had to look at the totality of your staff members. And a lot of districts did put a lot of social emotional programs in place and put wellness programs and wellness centers within schools. A lot of things were added post-pandemic okay. that are still being implemented.
Okay. Well, that's good
not
to know.
Wait, I just want to say not just for students, but also for staff.
For staff. Okay. Yeah, I feel bad for teachers. I mean, I really do. Because, you know, they go through it. First of all, they're underpaid and overworked. The responsibilities they're given with no autonomy is beyond the pale. And I just think they're very unappreciated and often the ones that are in the trenches that are often left behind, to be honest with you, mentally and psychologically. You did mention something that I wanted to, because this, as you know, it's what, Mental Health Awareness Month, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the biggest reasons I wanted to have you on today is because it's one thing to hear people talk about it on the outside, mm-hmm. but not to know exactly what that means and how important it is. You know, it was important to me that my listeners know, which is why I have you here today.
Okay.
But the U.S. Surgeon General mentioned last week, was it Vivek Murthy? I think that's his name, Dr. Vivek Murthy, was talking mm-hmm. about loneliness being an epidemic in this country. And mm-hmm. he read off some statistics, which I was shocked about, and I don't necessarily completely understand, but he said that loneliness causes a 29% increase in heart disease, a 32% mm-hmm. increase in stroke, a 50% increase in dementia amongst older people, and a 60% increase or chance of a premature death. That's crazy to me. Like loneliness?
Yes.
Break that down for me, please.
Okay. So what happens, what you're really talking about is when we think of loneliness, we think, oh, I miss this one person.
Exactly.
But it's bigger than that when you start talking about these kinds of statistics. And I'm going to go back to pandemic time and social isolation. So the definition of societal loneliness is the feeling of being disconnected, isolated, or alienated due to the lack of a meaningful social connection. So think of people who were in their places alone, or in their places with abusers, or in their places, you know, in these isolated, stuck places that they literally could not get out of. And there was all these things that were going on in the world. And when you start talking about physical health and chronic illness or chronic loneliness, it's associated with those types of diseases because you don't move. You don't get up. You don't move around. You're not exercising. That's why it was such a big push. That's why Peloton was so big during the pandemic, because it offered people the idea that they could get a workout and a vigorous type of workout and get their bodies moving from the places of which they were. So that physical health becomes that much more important when you start talking about loneliness and isolation and disconnectedness. Mental health is so much bigger than I am just depressed or I am anxious. Your mind starts to going. So now you have these thoughts that are just kind of playing in your head, and you go through a lot of what ifs. And if you have no one there to talk to and bounce those ideas and those thoughts off of, it literally just goes into a big circle.
Right.
You have that reduced social connectedness. And then people particularly, and I keep going back to the pandemic because it was so critical, people were dying. People were losing people. And sometimes people were losing people right in the midst of them, and they felt helpless. So those types of things would definitely start colliding together,
right,
and start making their own narrative for you.
Wow.
It also, and that social isolation also has an increased risk for addictions to begin too.
Okay. What's interesting to me is, as bad as that sounds, he also said that the effects of social isolation is the equivalent of smoking 15 cigarettes a day, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
And I thought to myself, how does one measure that? But I guess it's all about, like you said, heart disease, movement, taking care of yourself during that time.
Yeah, we assume, so I'm a very active person. I know this is radio, but I'm a very active person. And it's one thing to assume that everyone is at least half as active as you are.
Right.
But if you really think about it, the majority, the reason that gym memberships go up in January, and, you know, depending on where people live in the United States or whatever country they live in, physical activity is not always something that people engage in.
Right. No, you have to make time for it.
Right. And you assume that people actually know how to actually engage in some level of physical activity. And it's so much easier to eat comfort foods and to eat foods and to engage in activities that are soothing and comforting, which is why that addiction piece becomes that much bigger. And when I say addiction, I don't necessarily just mean drugs, alcohol. I mean social media. I mean, you have to find an outlet in it. And sometimes it's healthy and sometimes it's not.
Well, what do you think, what kind of role do you think social media plays in the whole isolation area? Do you think it's made it worse for people? Because we seem to, you know, you have things that can completely make you a recluse. You have Amazon, they'll deliver anything to your house. You got HubGrub and all of this stuff. You've got, you never really have to leave your house anymore.
Right.
And people, I guess, are not. We don't know how to talk to each other anymore. Everything is through text. The art of conversation is left. It's like, how is social media playing a role for us? Is it a detriment to us as much as an asset?
So my personal take on, and my professional take on social media is, the six in one hand, half a dozen in the other.
Okay.
It's an integral component of who we are now. again, we spend almost 2 years on in front of our computers on a device. And that's how we were able to get our jobs done. That's how we were, as you mentioned, that's how we were able to get our groceries delivered. That's how we were able to get food. Like, all kinds of great things happen with social media. It's like anything else, though. You have to be able to modulate it, and you have to be able to mediate it and be able to balance it out to know, am I getting too far in? Am I getting too far over to the left? Should I come away from it? How much social interaction do I need to do here? You know, is there someone else I can talk to? Is there, for some people, social media became, those were the only voices that they got to hear during a period of time.
Right. Right.
And that was their connection to the outside. And that doesn't make it bad, but that does then decrease their social skills when they have to go and engage with a live person.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because a lot of the things that we used to be able to do as people in social gatherings, they mm-hmm. cause anxiety now because of like mass shootings, right?
Yes.
You know,
yes.
You don't want to go to a concert as much as you used to, or a ball game, or mm-hmm. a cookout, because you never know what's going to break off. You know what I mean? And that's caused a lot of anxiety. And anxiety and depression, and I think bipolar disorder, are the three things that are the leading causes of mental disorders in this country right now. Is that right?
Yes.
Sort of.
I'll go with you on that. I'll go back to it. I'm going to go with you on that for a little bit. because some are neurological and so not so much caused by one or the other. Some have some different origins to them. But yes, the depression, the anxiety, I'm following. Yes.
Okay. So does one manifest itself into the other? Like, what comes first, the chicken or the egg?
So that's hard to tell, right? And that's why I kind of was like, I don't know. I think that it's not really just a social media issue. It's not just a pandemic issue. You bring up a very interesting point about the being afraid to go into society and engage society as we knew it at one point. I think what happened with social media and the period that we were in that forced us to see online is that we were literally stopped in our tracks to actually observe and be aware of what was happening. I don't think any of those things weren't happening before, but we were constantly moving. We were always in and out, and some things you saw, some things you didn't see, some things you were right, you know, right there for, some things you weren't, some things you got at 6 o'clock that maybe happened at 2 o'clock. And I think what happened during a certain period is that we were forced to be still.
Okay.
And so all we were doing was watching that. Like, we were just literally locked in. And so everything that happened, you were so much more heightened, you're so much more aware of it. And now you have a different feeling about it. You have a different awareness of it. You have a different knowledge base for it. So I don't think it wasn't happening before. I just think that the awareness became different. And when you talk about mental illness and those different kinds of behaviors and categories of mental illness, anxiety and depression, I do think heightened, right? You know, in the last 3 to 5 years, particularly, they heighten. And coming out of the pandemic, yes, we are definitely much more aware and much more cautious about our environments than we were prior to.
So do you think it's something that'll work its way out? I mean, you know what I mean, over time?
I think there are coping strategies. I didn't mean to cut you off. I think there are coping strategies that need to happen. I think that there are definitely trainings and resiliency. Like, I talk a lot about resiliency. Those kinds of trainings definitely become that much more of a focal point. I think what we're learning how to do is understand what our bounce back is. And I don't think that was something, it's just like any other behavior. I don't think we had to focus on our bounce back before because we didn't have anything that we needed to really bounce
right.
back from.
Right.
Unless you had your own individual tragedy or your own, you know,
right.
individual situation that you had to come back from. We didn't have as a whole global community a need to learn a bounce back, but resiliency is the ability to adapt from an adverse situation. And I think that becomes this really big piece for us as a people to be able to understand what's your mindset going to be, because what you tell yourself is how you're going to react.
Right.
So if you keep telling yourself all this negative, that's how you're going to respond. If you start bringing in that growth mindset and being able to understand how challenges can become stepping stones and those kinds of things, that's how you respond to it.
So do you think that exercise, physical exercise, is a way to ward off some of the problems that we have with
Absolutely.
Our emotional? Okay.
Absolutely. Physical exercise, and one of the reasons, the biggest reason, is that it gets all of your it gets your neurons moving. It gets your whole neurological system, and it gets your whole system to moving around. And so you move that energy around. Self-care practices, exercise, mindfulness practices, sleep is huge. So many people don't sleep. People don't sleep. And so many people have trouble sleeping. Trying to find a good sleep routine is huge. Being able to eat the right things, what we feed ourselves, how we handle our bodies is critical.
I get beat up about the lack of sleep that I get on a daily basis.
Okay.
Like, I don't sleep. My sleep patterns are not good. Sometimes I work until 3 a.m. and I sleep for about 3 hours to get up and back at it again. So, but I've always been told two things. A, successful people rarely have time for sleep. And B, there's always time to sleep when you're dead. So,
okay, those are very interesting things.
So, okay. I don't, you know, I mean, I kind of grind, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Okay, so my own personal thought on the sleep is that I don't know if you necessarily need 8 hours. I know, you know, there have been all kinds of studies. One study says 8 hours, one says you only need 6. I don't know if the time of sleep is as important as the quality of your sleep.
Thank you.
If you get 3 good hours
right.
of sleep and you wake up and you feel like, okay, I can move to the next space and I can do it with ease, I think you've done yourself a good service. And the reason that I say that is because when you sleep, what you're doing is you're shutting off your brain. So if you can get three, four good hours where your brain is not doing anything and you're resetting, then you've done a good service. Here's how I liken it. If your computer starts to go haywire, your cell phone starts to just kind of, you know, none of your apps are opening and all kinds of things, what's the very first thing you do?
You shut it off. Yeah.
You shut it off for a period of time. You let it reboot. And then you turn it back on and voila, it is back in service.
Right.
And it's the same thing. You're a system, you have a rhythm, you have a flow. And when your system and your rhythm and your flow is off, you have to reset it. That's where that self-care piece comes in.
Right.
That's where you know when your eating is off. You know, some people's skin breaks out. Some people get upset stomach. What do? You stop, you reset. And you eat differently.
Right. Well, I got two more things and I'll let you roll. One of them is, as a black man, right, mm-hmm. I know the feeling of telling someone that you're going to get therapy, you're going to talk to a therapist or get medication. It's a feeling of weakness, shame or embarrassment. And that feeling has quietly kept a lot of men like myself in peril, emotional peril, right?
Okay.
We just don't reach out to get it for that reason. Now, I started seeing a therapist finally, and it's opened up all kinds of doors. I mean, I feel great, but I wanted to know what it is about that stigma. Like, where did it come from? Why is it there? And how we can get past it as a community of black men?
I think that it's long term. I don't think it just started 10 years ago, 5 years ago. I think there's always been a stigma, particularly in the black community, not just with black men, but in the black community about going to see a therapist. You know, in the black community, particularly, I can speak to that just because I grew up in it. And I remember being in grad school. We would rather go sit in our grandmother's kitchen or with our aunts or with our uncles or whoever, where our safe space is, and hash out our problems than to go to someone we don't really know or think we don't trust to tell them our problems. That's one thing. But I think that that has shifted, and those myths have been shattered along the way, because I think we realize that we need more, and that we need to allow ourselves to trust a little bit more. I think we're more knowledgeable and we're more aware of therapy. I always say, though, that people are not excited to go see their therapist.
Nobody, true.
Nobody says, oh, I'm going to see my therapist today. I can't wait to go. Nobody does that.
Not if you're doing the work.
Instead, people say, ooh, I got to go see my therapist.
Right,
today.
Right.
Because they know that they're going to break down a door, and they know they're going to have to bring that effort. But that's actually a good thing, because after they see their therapist, they come out like, you know what, I want to see my therapist today, and I think you should go see a therapist because of these reasons. So it's not the same kind of happy, joyous place that you go, but it's the necessary place that you go.
Absolutely.
It's like any other kind of doctor. But even with Black men, I think about Black men in therapy. There's a Black therapist, male therapist, and he's all around social media. Jay Barnett, I love him. I love his transparency. And I think he and the group and the organizations that he works with does a lot to help to break the stereotype of Black men going to therapists and being able to be vulnerable enough and still hold on to their manhood and still being able to hold on to their masculinity to go and address those things that have been weighing them down.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely masculinity loss attached to admitting that you've seen a therapist or that you're seeing one. I mean, you feel it when you say it, depending on who you're saying it to.
I don't know if it gets lost or if it's something that was implanted. It's almost like an implanted seed that says, if you go see a therapist, you lose something. When the reality is, if you go see a therapist, you might gain something. You might gain a part of you that you thought you had lost. You might gain a part of you that you had hidden for a while. You might gain a part of you that needed to grow. I don't think it's a negative, not just because I sit on that side of the table, but because I just understand the value that's in it. And I think, like I said, it's a seed that has to be plucked up and say, no, that's not really the narrative that we want to walk with. I'm back to what we say to ourselves and how we talk to ourselves.
I know that you are not an expert in the drug field. You're not a psychiatrist. But how do you feel about antidepressants as opposed to maybe holistic approaches?
So I don't... I think that they're good for what they're good for. I don't have a bias one way or the other to them. I always say to when I work with families, for example, and I'm working with a student that might have a medication prescription, I always say what the medication does is it's not a cure-all. The medication helps you to gain access to those cognitive functions that you need to move through whatever that impasse is.
Okay.
So it's a means to an end. And another example that I give is I have asthma. I could choose not to take my asthma medicine and still function around here. The problem is going to be I'm not going to be breathing as well.
Okay.
So right. I take the medication, not because my asthma goes away, but I take the medication so that I can breathe properly, so that I can get through the day without having that limp or that struggle or that impasse to kind of keep following me every step of the way. So I think medication has its place. I don't have a problem with it one way or the other. I think that you also need more than that sometimes, though. I think sometimes we think that if we take the medicine that it's a magic pill and it's going to cure that. It probably will get you closer to you being available to get now the strategies and to use the coping skills and the treatment plans that are being offered to you.
How can we recognize as parents or friends or loved ones signals or symptoms in people that we care about that they might need some help? And how do we recognize it in ourselves?
I think in others, you have to be aware of who they are. I think if you're looking at something like a mental health concern, you're noticing any shifts in patterns of behavior. If you know that someone is generally just a very happy, outgoing person, and now all of a sudden they've kind of pulled to the back, and they are more isolated and don't really, you know, are not as social and not as engaging, that would be one thing to kind of look and say, hey, is something going on? You know, do you need to talk? And that's always a good end. Like, do you need to talk? Also, if you know, I want to kind of back to something that you talked about with Black men and stereotypes.
Okay.
If someone is very strong, I always say check on your strong friends.
Okay.
If someone is very strong and they say to you, hey, I don't think I'm okay, hear them.
Okay.
Don't say, because you know them, oh, you're okay, don't
you
worry
got this.
About it. No. Just say, okay, I hear you. Like, I heard you. Let's talk. Let's talk through it, and then get a little bit more information, a little bit more awareness. I think awareness becomes the big key factor here.
Right.
And you just being able to know people and being able to see changes in behaviors and activities. Within oneself, again, I'm going to go with awareness, knowing yourself, knowing when something feels off in you. If you had a cold or you just started feeling some kind of ache and pain in your body, the very first thing that you would do is you would say, I don't know, my leg is seeming like it's not okay. I think I'm going to call my doctor, right?
Right.
But
right.
If you have some kind of shift in your thought process, or you know some big events have kind of shifted your mindset and changed your mood, you might want to say, you know what, I may need to just go and talk to someone. And just like if you go talk to any doctor and you get there and they say, we didn't find anything, at least you went. And there is some record that, you know what I mean, that you
right.
at least want to address it. And now you feel better. Now you can figure out, what do I need to do next?
You know, what's weird about that is I was in the military, and I've lost a lot of my friends to suicide in the last 3 or 4 mm-hmm. years. Right. And so we have a group where we check in. We do exactly that, you know, on Facebook, where we check in. But what I have found is there have been times where I wasn't suicidal at all, but I certainly wasn't okay, where I felt like, but because everybody else is saying they're okay, you don't want to say that you're not feeling okay. You know what I mean? It's like reverse peer pressure. So how do we combat that? Like, how, because I think at the end of the day, the most honest person you have to be with is yourself. And I don't think we are most of the time.
I would say in that situation that you find your trusted safe space. So you may have to just find that safe person and say, you know, I really am not okay. I'm like, something is off. And I think if you say it to a trusted person that knows you, so I'm back to awareness, they know you, then they will be the ones to say, okay, let's just talk through it then. You know, it may, like you said, you're not suicidal. You're not feeling like you want to harm yourself.
Right.
But you may feel like you need to talk. And I think a lot of times we feel like we're bothering people.
Exactly.
And we're invading on people.
Right.
But the reality is that if you are considered a good friend, those are the people that you want to be able to talk to. Those are the people that you want to hear you. And those are the people that you want to be heard with, because it goes back to this understanding of, I heard this definition of intimacy. Dr. Renita Weems, she's a theologian. This was years ago. She wrote this book called I Ask for Intimacy. And when she was doing, this was literally in the 80s, when she did this tour on this book, her definition of intimacy was the knowing and being known by someone naked, and it's okay. And she said the naked is not physical nakedness, but it's in their vulnerability, and it's okay. And that's really what true friendship is. Because if you think about your true friends, they know your goods, your bads. they know all those little places, and you know, it's all good. It's like,
right.
Okay, I still love you. let's go get some ice cream now. We're good.
But
you know?
She said the V word. And vulnerability and masculinity often live on complete opposite sides of the street.
They do. And I think that becomes where you have to become aware of who you are and understanding that vulnerability does not make you weak.
Okay.
Vulnerability a lot of times makes you that much stronger. Now, it's a difference between being vulnerable and just relinquishing who you are.
Right.
Being vulnerable is really just your being able to be, this is who I am, like being transparent about those places. And again, it's never what you do, it's always how you do it. But if you're just kind of giving off this all the time, that's a different issue. But vulnerability is not a bad thing.
Okay.
And you don't have to lose yourself in vulnerability. You just have to be able to say, okay, I just want to let you know this is a real place for me.
Right. Well, listen, the time has escaped us. I'm so, so appreciative of you being here. And you are now officially a member of the 1500 Radio family. And
well, thank you so much.
Well, you say that, but I'm going to be calling you on you again. So be ready.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for this opportunity.
All right, Dr. Bolden, you take care of yourself now, okay?
Thank you, and thank you to your audience. Have a very good afternoon, and I will talk to you soon.
Thank you.
Be careful and have self-care.
Absolutely. Till next time. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
I love having people on, experts in their field, that can speak to me in simple terms without making me feel simple. You know what I mean? So I thank the good Dr. Bolden for coming on today and explaining some things to us and giving us some great knowledge about what's going on with our mental health. But I know you hear the music, so you know what time it is. It is time for the Petty. Let's get him on the phone and to see what he's talking about this week.
Brother B, good morning to you.
Good morning to you, sir. It is the Petty. Welcome. How you doing?
I'm doing just great, brother. And how are you?
Hey, man, I'm trying to hang in there. What you got for me this week, man? There's a lot that's been going on, so I want to hear what you got to say.
First of all, I want to start with the XFL.
Okay.
Man, all right. I knew it. I knew the D.C. Defenders would be there. The Arlington Renegades kind of threw me there for a second, pulling up the upset over Wade Phillips and his Houston.
That shocked me.
Roughnecks.
Shocked
me. I mean, this was just incredible. But you know what? Wade Phillips said it best. He said, you know, it's hard to beat the same team three times in one season. And you know what? You know, it was the Battle of Texas. Arlington came out on top. They will be in Texas, in San Antonio, Texas, in the Alamo Dome, playing against the D.C. Defenders on May the 13th. That is Saturday.
Right.
Saturday afternoon. And that's going to be for the XFL championship game. And I honestly believe that the Defenders will win that game.
Really? You know, I believe it too. I hope so anyway.
I mean, the Defenders starting to look real good, and I think, you know, they'll win the championship. Their offense is pretty decent. Their defense, I think Defenders are the team that will win this year. I said it earlier. They looked good. They were 9-1. They had that one upsetting loss against
the worst team in the league.
Exactly, the worst team in the league. And outside of that, they were just rolling right along. You know, Seattle was not even a threat to them when they played last week.
Right.
So look for the Defenders to be the champs. And with that being said, Reggie Barlow, the Defenders head coach, was named XFL Coach of the Year.
I saw that. I think that's excellent.
And that's just fantastic. And one final note on the XFL. The ageless one, Wade Phillips, says he will be back next year.
Oh, wow. Okay.
To lead the Houston Roughnecks.
All right,
to
Wade.
A championship. He'll be 76 next year. He says he's coming back. He's not done coaching.
You're not done. You're not done.
You know, I like Wade Phillips. He's just like his dad. You know, I'm sorry that he's not in the NFL. I think you could give some of the defenses some of his experience that he had when he was an NFL coach.
Right.
He shows he's still a good coach by doing what he did with the Houston Roughnecks in the XFL. And finally, with the XFL, 19 XFL players have been invited for NFL tryouts or to their rookie minicamps. And that's pretty decent. One of them being a former XFL player, and that was Ben DiNucci, who was a backup for the Dallas Cowboys. He'll have a tryout with the Denver Broncos.
That's awesome. That's awesome.
So that's pretty good. Moving on to the other football league, the USFL. We have a big game this afternoon at 3 o'clock on NBC. The two best teams in the league, the New Orleans Breakers, who are undefeated, will take on the Jersey Generals.
Okay.
They're the two best teams in the league. You know, New Orleans has the best record with a 3-0. Jersey's 2-1. And they both have the two top running backs in the league this year. And the one that you really need to look at is Darius Victor for the New Jersey Generals.
Yeah, he's nice.
He's only 5. Yeah, he is. He's only 5'8". He's like a little bowling ball. He's tough. He kind of reminds me of Ray Rice. And that's going to be a good game. I think I'm gonna check that game out.
Yeah, it's gonna be good.
I'm still sad to say that the attendance is very low for the USFL. I watched the game last week, and it was a very good game between the Pittsburgh Maulers and the Philadelphia Stars. And it seemed like there was basically hardly no one in the stands.
I know, man.
And it's really sad because the play on the field is pretty good. I enjoyed that game. And like I said earlier, a couple of weeks back, that I think the USFL play is better than the XFL play. But there are more people going out to see the XFL.
Right. And, you know, I don't know if it's because those guys play in a more intimate setting with smaller venues. Or because, you know, the Defenders don't play in the FedEx Field. They play in the DC United Field, which is almost half the size. So I'm wondering if that's the case.
Well, the case being that the XFL has better attendance than the USFL is because, like I said before, USFL is only playing in four hub cities, whereas the XFL, they're playing in the cities that they represent. So, you know, I had said this a couple of weeks ago. I live in the Philadelphia area. If I wanted to see the Philadelphia Stars play, I would either have to travel to Canton, Ohio, or to Detroit, Michigan.
Yeah, yeah, I see what you're saying.
I'm not doing that.
Right, I
have
got
no
you.
Problem traveling a half an hour, even an hour away to watch the Stars, but we're talking about going to a different state altogether with
right.
two states.
Gotcha.
So that's just not going to happen. It's a shame because I would like to see the USFL play up close and personal. Moving right along, we're going to talk about the NFL. Their mini camps will be starting soon. They'll be having OTAs. And your quarterback, the highest paid player in the NFL right now, Lamar Jackson, has said with the new weapons he has, his goal is to pass for 6,000 yards.
Yeah, I heard that. And I'm like, damn.
Okay. Well, I could maybe see it happening if the offensive line holds up. But here's the thing. Lamar has to play a whole season for that to happen. And you tell me. Brother B, when was the last time he played a full season?
I think it was his rookie year.
Exactly. And even then, he came in relief of Joe Flacco.
Exactly,
Joe Flacco never got off the bench after that. So he has yet to play a full scheduled season in the NFL.
I don't know. $255 million is a hell of a incentive. You know what I mean? Because I think he could have played the last two games of the season. I think he opted not to be honest with you.
And I agree with 100%. I think he felt as though, why should I take this risk? I want to be a free agent.
Exactly.
If I get injured,
exactly.
I might not get the money that I'm looking for. And, you know, he got paid. And he did without an agent. So kudos to Lamar Jackson.
Right.
And I'm telling you right now, if he throws for 5,000 yards, that would be a milestone.
Absolutely.
And 6,000, nobody's going to break that record. Not in my lifetime. I just won't see 6,000 if he gets that outside of him doing it.
If he throws for 4,000, I'm sorry, brother, but if he throws for 4,000 yards, it will shut up people who say he's just a running quarterback.
Well, you know what, brother B, this is what disturbs me. I watched Josh Allen up in Buffalo run just as many times as Lamar Jackson, and they're calling him a quarterback.
Yeah, but you know what that's all about. You know what that's all about.
We all know what that's all about because they're calling Lamar Jackson a running back that just happens to play quarterback.
Exactly.
No, he's a quarterback.
Right.
He has a very good arm. I've seen him, like he just flicked the ball and it went 60, 70 yards down the field.
Michael Vick
is a good quarterback.
The exact same way. It's just one is right-handed, the other's left. But they flick the ball the same way.
They said the exact same thing about Michael Vick. And Michael Vick, I've seen him throw the ball down the field, especially when he played up here in Philadelphia. He just threw some passes to Deshaun Jackson that were just incredible.
Absolutely.
Caught him in stride.
The game that they played against the Redskins on Monday night, the very opening play threw for 92 yards or something to DeSean Jackson.
And you know what?
A dime.
That showed that he had an arm right there.
Exactly.
So that should have shut up all the naysayers. And I've seen Lamar throw some very good passes, and they still look at his running.
Right.
Well, these days, you need to have a mobile quarterback. You need to have one.
Everybody's got one. I mean, look, man, you had two in the Super Bowl.
And they will call quarterbacks. Neither one of them will call running backs that play the quarterback position.
But they often ran from outside. They often threw from outside of the pocket.
And you have to. You can't sit back. Now, there have been some very good pocket passers in the past. There still are a few good pocket passers out there. But you have to be able to move around. You have to be mobile. You have to be able to slide to the left, slide to the right. You know, get out of the pocket. Maybe just take off and run. And nothing's there. If nothing's there and you see nothing but green grass, go. And that's what Lamar Jackson does.
I mean,
and I applaud him for doing that. He just has to find a way to stay healthy, to stay on the field.
The thing is, what people don't talk about is not necessarily the mobility of the quarterback and why they run, but the mobility of defensive linemen has evolved. You know what I'm saying? They don't just go forward anymore. The thing that was great about Lawrence Taylor was his speed and his ability to rush from the outside. Well, everybody in the league can do that now. So the quarterbacks have to be mobile now.
Yeah, absolutely right. These guys are getting bigger, stronger, and they're getting faster.
Exactly.
So the quarterback just can't stand back there like a statue waiting for his receiver to get open. He has to be mobile.
Correct. And what people don't realize is every time Lamar's been hurt, he's been hurt while in the pocket, not when he's been running.
Well, if you remember years ago, and you may not, but I do. I remember a quarterback by the name of Randall Cunningham.
Of course I remember Randall.
Very mobile. Yeah. Very mobile. But you know how he got injured?
In the pocket.
In the pocket.
Yeah.
So sometimes it's good to have a mobile quarterback. Roll him out. Find some plays that he rolls out to the left or rolls out to the right. You know, move the pocket a little bit if you have to. Do what you got to do to protect your quarterback. And if he takes off and run, then okay, that's fine too. But don't make it where he has to run all the time.
Right. Well, it's going to be fun.
Be lineman and protect him.
It's going to be fun watching Lamar this year for sure. I can't wait.
And now, Brother B, I got to talk about these guys because I'm liking what I see right now. And I told you last week, you know, a lot of people sleeping on them. You have not heard too much about those high-flying Orioles.
Right,
they are finally getting it done. They are the second best team in the majors. Can you believe it? And that's the only reason they're the second best team because they're behind those red hot Tampa Rays.
Yeah,
all of those guys donning the orange and black. You said you don't know who their names are.
Hey, look, look,
they're getting it done.
I know, bro. I know. I watched the game with your father a week ago when they played Detroit in the doubleheader, and he. You know, he's not impressed with the O's yet. He says it's too early to tell.
Well, okay, it is early in the season. We're in early May. I get it, but you gotta like what you're saying right now.
Yeah.
You gotta like it. There's something to talk about. You know, and I think if they can carry that momentum into June and July, we come around late August and early September, like I said before, we might be looking at a playoff team. Even if they just make it to the wild card.
Right.
Still, they're a playoff team. They're getting it done very quietly. Nobody's talking about the O's.
No, but you said you like it that way.
Oh, I love it. Because that's when they creep up on you all of a sudden. The Orioles are there. Who are these guys?
Right.
Outside of Adley Rutschman and maybe Cedric Mullins.
And Bautista. Bautista.
Well, definitely Bautista. Yeah. I call him Senior Heat. those are the only three players that I really can name right off.
Me too.
And, you know, everybody else is like, who are these guys?
Right.
But they are getting it done, Brother B. And Oriole Park should be rocking and rolling. I mean, I'm pretty sure, and I know for a fact, because I've gotten some tickets in May, that you can just get tickets like it's nothing.
You're absolutely right.
I'm going to a game later this month, and it was very easy to get a ticket.
Yeah.
So I'm telling you, tell the people who are listening to your show, go down there and support the O's. Fill up Oriole Park and support those guys because they are getting it done. They're getting it done quietly. But they are something to talk about.
Yo, guess what? They're listening to you on the show, so you can tell them.
Go support the O's. If I'm talking about the O's, then you need to go see them. Because you know I'm not a big fan of Baltimore sports.
I know.
Those high-flying Orioles.
I hear you, bro.
And finally, a little bit of disappointing news. Tank Davis.
Right.
Maybe facing jail time.
What?
Well, the brother was out there before his last title fight. Another hit and run.
And
a bodily injury occurred to a pregnant woman. And he was driving on a revoked license. He ran a red light. He had an accident, and then he fled the scene of the accident. That does not look well for the champ. It doesn't look well at all.
It doesn't.
He has a court date where he just may see some jail time. They tried to do a little plea bargain, and the judge rejected the offer. So now it's up to the judge to decide Tank Davis's fate. So I'm a little disappointed to hear about that. I'm disappointed when I hear about any popular athlete that has a lot of talent going out there doing just dumb stuff. And
exactly.
Why are you in Baltimore City driving a freaking Lamborghini anyway?
Because he's Tank Davis, he's young, he's got a lot of money, and he flexes. I mean, it's really that simple. When you're young, you flex. It is that simple.
Well, these young men need to take a course on how to flex and to be safe to preserve their money and their legacy. Because this is just, it just doesn't look well. Well, it doesn't look well, though. And I'm so very disappointed in that young man, because I think he's one of the top. He's in the top 10. Let me say this again. In the top 10 best pound per pound boxers.
Right.
That's something said. That's something being said about him and his talent. Don't go out there doing something stupid.
No, I feel you. I feel you.
So it's just disappointing. And I hope he comes out of this on the plus side. And I hope he learns a lesson, and I hope he changes things around. He's supposed to have a fight coming up pretty soon. We'll see how this court thing plays out. And, of course, we'll talk about the upcoming fight that he has.
All right. Well, do me a favor, man. Next time, let something like this lead your segment. You know what I'm saying?
Wow.
I'm just saying, this is huge, bro. I hadn't heard anything about this. So, yeah, this is big.
Well, sometimes you gotta save the best for last. To me, that was the best thing out of everything I've talked about so far this morning.
Yeah, no doubt.
So I'm saving that for last.
No doubt. All right, I got you. I'll see you.
And on that note, since I said that was the last thing, Brother B, I am out of here. I gotta go. Peace.
All right, Petty, I'll talk to you next week. All right, well, you heard it from the Petty. And like I said, the last few weeks has been really refreshing. I mean, he's talked about a lot of stuff, not just the football stuff, which I love and he's amazing at. But he's also given us an insight to some other things like baseball that, you know, I grew up watching baseball just like he did. We were both junior Orioles when we were a kid. So, you know, I can understand why he loves the O's. And pretty soon he's going to be back with the purple and black. I promise you. I can feel it. He's coming in our direction. Anyway, we heard from him. Of course, we heard from Dr. Baldwin. And I'm so thankful that she came. I need you to get at me and give me some feedback what you think about today's show. Hit me on IG at On with Brian Pettaway. Can't wait to hear what you have to say. Again, it helps our show just get better. And with this show in particular, I can't wait to hear the feedback because, again, we need that interaction, right? So that being said, I got to run. We may have run a little bit over today, but it's okay. Remember, this is May, Mental Health Awareness Month. Get out there, people. Be social. Enjoy your life. I know we've had a lot going on during the pandemic. I know there's a lot of things that go on that make us anxious, but we got to start enjoying life. Don't be a recluse. Don't think that you can do everything from your house and get everything you need because you're unbothered. We need each other. So let's start doing that, all right? Let's make that a priority that we all get together at some point and enjoy each other's company. All right, I got to go. Enjoy your Sunday. Do nothing. Wake up tomorrow, conquer the world, because like I say every Sunday, the best thing about doing nothing is you can quit whenever you want. I love you guys. Thank you so much, and I'll see you next week. Peace!